Hello and welcome once again to Tales from the Reuther Library, a podcast coming to you from the Walter P. Reuther Library on the campus of Wayne State University in the beating heart of Detroit, Michigan. I am Dan Galadner, your host, and with me, always, and on her free will, is Troy Eller English. How's it going, Troy?
I'm great. How are you, Dan?
Excellent. Excellent. Spring is almost here, isn't it?
Almost. Northern climates, it's perhaps almost here.
Almost. You never know. I mean, we're probably going to get snow in June. Who doesn't?
Probably.
Probably.
We didn't get much January through...
No, we never do.
February, March.
We never do, so they're going to catch up in the summer.
Sure.
So we'll be a tropical zone in the winter.
Yeah.
And then shift over to the cold winter in the summer times.
Yes.
Perfect. I can't wait for the droughts. You know? Okay. Today's podcast, we talk with Rachel Steyer and her book, Betty Friedan, Magnificent Disruptor. Steyer is an award-winning essayist and critic who is head of dramaturgy and dramatic criticism program at the theater school at DePaul University in Chicago, and who is the author of Striptease, The Untold History of Girly Show, Gypsy, The Art of the Tease, and The Steal, A Cultural History of Shoplifting. Steyer has written a wonderful biography about Betty, the noted feminist and author of Feminine Mystique, founder of the National Organization for Women, and other things as well. And it was just put out by Yale University last year. You know, there has not been a biography on Betty for over 20 years, and it is sorely needed to remind us of this amazing woman and for the generations that are only slightly aware of her. Steyer is balanced in her writing about Betty, starting with her upbringing in Illinois to writing in New York City with the Federated Press News Agency, her estrangement from her family, her encounters with anti-Semitism, love affairs, marriage, divorce, but also it's about her stardom with being the mother to the feminist movement, how she became a star with her book, The Feminist Mystique, a star with the founding of the National Organization for Women, a star to become the elder stateswoman for a generation, challenging and gritting her teeth to advance the dignity of women in a man's world. Through the book, we learn about her nonstop pace. And she did not care who she knocked down, insulted, or what group she really, really pissed off. She isolated herself with her statements about lesbians and African Americans, but then was loved for her development of a movement, her fight for equality in the law and abortion rights and so many other things. She was combative, aggressive, and even though she was from the Midwest, she had that sort of New York City way about her, and I think you know what I'm talking about. Steyer visited numerous archives and conducted over 100 interviews to put the life of Betty before us. So I completely encourage you to all read Betty Friedan's Magnificent Disruptor to remind us of the battles won and lost for equality, on how society treated women and still treat women, on what a courageous person can do at any cost. Rachel, thank you for joining Tales from the Reuther. We really appreciate you being on our podcast. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. As I was just saying, I spent a few very happy days there a few years ago. Yeah.
It is a happy place, isn't it?
Yeah, it was nice. It was lovely.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Good. So, all right. So, first question, what was the inspiration to write about Betty Friedan? I mean, there's a large amount of content out there. What do you think was missing?
Well, first I should say this was a commission from the series Yale Jewish Lives, published by Yale University Press. And it really started 10 years ago when I wrote an article for the Chronicle of Higher Education Review about the 50th anniversary of the Feminine Mystique. And at that time, I had not read The Feminine Mystique, full disclosure. And so I was shocked to find that I found it very moving and in some places extremely persuasive. And overall, it had a force that I had not expected. And then I was reviewing it or writing about it alongside of several other books by feminists younger feminists, you know, fourth wave feminists, I suppose, or third wave, that had come out that year in 2013. And I was also somewhat shocked to see that all of the books, to some extent, either amplified Betty's argument or argued with it, expanded it, whatever, they did something with it, but they barely mentioned her name, barely attributed the arguments to her. And so I became very interested in that. And the piece that I wrote was about how Betty had been erased. And a lot of people liked the piece. And then a little time passed, and out of that came this commission.
Excellent. It was a needed piece of work, I must say.
Thanks.
We kind of start at the beginning of her career. You write a great biography of where she was raised, how she developed. And the purpose for your visit here was her work with the Federated Press and Labor Press that not many people know at all. They just assume straight away feminist movement material, but she was part of the labor movement for all. How important was her writing to the labor press?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I should say that I am not the first person to write about Betty's involvement in the labor press. That person was really Dan Horowitz, who wrote a previous biography about Betty that was published in 1998, an excellent biography. And he was the first one to really bring this all to light. He had an argument which had to do, in his book, he talks about how Betty diminished her time with the labor movement, writing for Federated Press and then for UE a little bit later in the 50s, in order to really exaggerate, I'm talking about his book, exaggerate her time as her identity as a housewife. Mm-hmm. And Dan's argument is that Betty did this because she felt that, you know, she wanted to reach as wide an audience as possible. And this was also the McCarthy era, and she was concerned that she would be discredited. So anyway, I just say this to say I'm not the first person to write about, but her work with the labor press is enormously important. I don't think you can really understand both her triumphs, if you will, in the feminine mystique, and then in organizing later with the National Organization for Women and many other organizations that she founded or co-founded in the 60s and 70s. And I don't think you can understand also the failures, failures isn't really the right word, but just her limitations as a person, as a leader, as a, you know, as a writer. I mean, there were certain things that came later for women who were younger and who were in the movement that Betty could never get on board with, in part because she was so imbued and she had absorbed so deeply, so heavily, the values of the labor press and the labor movement.
Right, that's sums it up perfectly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, that article that Horowitz wrote, I mean, he wrote the book later, but he wrote an article.
Yes.
And boy, yes. Betty was not happy with that.
No. This was a big thing, issue with his book. Of course, she was, you know, one difference between my biography and his biography, and also the biography of Judith Hennessy, who's the other person who wrote about Betty in the 90s, was that Betty was still alive when the biographies were being written. And so she had the opportunity to weigh in, which for a biographer is not always desirable. And she contested Dan's point of view. Till the end of her life, she diminished that part of her identity, I would say. She diminished it, and yet at the same time, she continued to sort of embody it, right? There was obviously this deep conflict in her because she, you know, she appeared at various rallies. She was always talking about how in the economic downturn, women were suffering. You know, she talked about families and how families were suffering under Reagan, Reagan's policies. So, I mean, yes, she objected to what Dan was saying, but at the same time, as I said, she continued to advance an idea of women's rights that was deeply connected to other kinds of what I consider to be, I don't know, values of the old left.
Right.
So, as I said, I think there is this real conflict. I mean, I think it came from this deep insecurity that she had that there would not be a space for women to advance just as women, right? That if, you know, if you were talking about the left and the labor movement, there that would, women's rights would be like would disappear in that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was her anxiety. And that was that anxiety really was the seed of most of her disagreements with younger feminists, radical feminists, and so on.
Right, right. She always seemed to be sometimes coming across as a protected of women's issues within a moderate stance.
Yes.
Even though she was doing some radical stuff.
Yes, correct. Like, yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Right. Moderate is a good word, or centrist, whatever. Yeah, absolutely. Because she never support, you know, she never got on board with any kind of identity politics or what she called sexual politics, anything down with the patriarchy, separatism, lesbian rights, black power, feminism. She didn't, she worried again that all of that would shatter the women's movement and would prevent and would distract the media and would just prevent the core issues, would prevent women from, you know, achieving or fulfilling these core issues, which to her were pay equity, childcare, equality and political representation and business representation. I think, I mean, pay equality, that comes directly, obviously, from her work as with Federated Press and so on, right? Childcare, she was writing about childcare when she was a journal, you know, child issues when she was at Federated Press. Reproductive rights, she was mm-hmm. concerned about that since the 40s. But the other issues that started to bubble up, you know, to rise to the surface with the founding of women's liberation in 1968, she was never on board with those issues.
No, she saw it as clouding the whole issues and taking
clouding.
Away exactly what you're saying. So,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Betty seemed to be involved with a lot of conflict within herself of the personal identity. And most
yes.
what comes across is her Jewish identity.
Yes.
What evolutions did you see of her Jewishness coming through her life?
Yes, yes. Well, I think, you know, the way you frame the question is exactly how I think about it. I mean, first of all, she was, as you're pointing out, she was a pugilist in all of her relationships, including her relationship with herself and her own Jewishness. And so I would say, you know, she grew up in a Reform Jewish family in a small town in Southern Illinois, where she felt like an outsider. And she also felt like an outsider in her own family because she was extremely brainy and her mother was very poised, beautiful, and concerned with surfaces and assimilation. Whereas she, you know, she was different and was sort of was hurling that in everybody's face, including her family's face, I think from the very beginning. I mean, that became her strategy for coping with this profound feeling of being an outsider. And then I think over time, you know, she went to Smith where she encountered a more genteel version of anti-Semitism at Smith. Mm-hmm. Although also at Smith, she found herself, you know, a kind of intellectual home despite that. And then she didn't really start to talk about herself as Jewish until the 70s, So in other words, until she was really around 50. I mean, she barely talked about it publicly before then. And I think that, but once she did begin to talk about it, it became clear that the way she thought about it was her early experiences with anti-Semitism created the conditions for her to fight for women's rights. Obviously she saw women as a kind of other or outsider. And so that really, her outsiderness generated her fight for other outsiders. And then I would say as time went on, continued to go on into her 50s and 60s, she further explored her own Jewishness, and she tried to, she did a number of things. She certainly tried to fight for female rabbis. She worked to help Israeli women start the first independent Israeli feminist organization. She also explored a more mystical side of Judaism. So there were many incarnations of her Jewishness that she continued to explore throughout her life. And she did attend temple. She certainly saw herself as culturally Jewish. And she's buried in a Jewish cemetery.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, that's exactly the trajectory that I would say some people do take, coming from a Reformed Judaism and then also getting older, exploring who they are and reaching back into, wow, there's this mystical part of Judaism that's I never knew about. What is all this? You know?
And it had to also do with her children, I think. And as she grew older, particularly her middle son, Jonathan, and I think she was very influenced by her children, really. And so watching Jonathan explore his Jewishness and later his Judaism, I think she took something from that and she began her own investigation, that not mirrored his, but it was inspired by his.
It's amazing how sometimes the kids actually influence the parents sometimes.
Yeah, that's a happy circumstance, I think.
It is. It was interesting that you bring up the children because her daughter mentioned that she wasn't a feminist.
Initially.
How did Betty respond to that?
Betty raised her children to be independent thinkers. I think she was certainly not happy about that, but later also, once her daughter went to medical school, she also retracted that statement. I mean, I think it's exactly what we were talking about a minute before the podcast, which is when you're young, you may not see that the women who have gone before you, what have been their fights and what have been their struggles and advances, and what is the need for feminism today? I think that Betty's daughter's refusal of feminism comes out of that in part. I also think there was an enormous mother-daughter struggle in the early years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically any mother-daughter relationship, basically.
Yeah, I mean, what better way to irritate your mother, the famous feminist, than to say you're not a feminist, right?
Really got to her that way. also on conflict, and basically Betty was her worst enemy sometimes with her conflict. Her temper, her volatile attitude, impatience. There were times when I was reading this, seriously, when I was going, oh, no, don't say that. Don't do that. And she did.
Yeah.
Could you name a couple or maybe one that really stands out? They had your head shaking.
Yeah. The most famous one is the Lavender Menace, which really haunted her. That was something that Betty used that phrase in 1969 at a National Organization for Women meeting in New Orleans. And at the time, she was, as I said earlier, she was very concerned that lesbian women would make their concerns coming out of the closet and lesbian rights central to the National Organization for Women platform. And Betty worried that this would diminish the wide mass appeal of the National Organization for Women. And so she used the phrase Lavender Menace to try and shut it down. And as I said, it, you know, the phrase was, you know, so widely repeated, you know, and Betty was so scorned for the phrase really until the end of her life. If you, in the archives, I mean, there's just like letter after letter after letter, you know, from young women, really, particularly, you know, in 1969, you said, what do you have to say about this? And, you know, she did apologize for it in 1977, but I don't think that that satisfied, frankly, a lot of her critics. You know, and I think she was, Betty was very concerned, and this was also another reason why she reacted so strongly to Dan's book, was that she was very concerned about her legacy, and she did not want her legacy to be only these, characterological explosions, these critiques. She wanted, obviously, her legacy to even be more than the feminine mystique. She wanted it to be the whole arc of her career, her evolution, and she was just afraid that things like this would, you know, would capsize it.
Right. And the thing is with Betty, though, she was everywhere for everything. So understanding that she was worried about these few things, marring her arc, as you said, it's impossible to do that in a way when you look at her life of going everywhere, doing everything, starting everything, being in, starting now, and starting this. And then what I love, all right, this is how I see Betty, right? She starts now, goes with it as president for, because she had to be there. She had to be in front of this new organization, but ready to step down and hand it over reluctantly, I guess, in one way. But her parting shot is saying, oh, by the way, I'm retiring, but we are going to have a women's strike for equality.
Right. In five months. Right. Exactly. I mean, that was classic Betty. That's the thing. Right. I mean, everything you're saying is exactly it. I mean, also, I should say, though, that she knew that she was aware of her flaws. Right. Because when she was recruited or asked if she would be president of the National Organization for Women, she initially was hesitant to do so because, as she put it, I have a writer's temperament, right? I mean, so she knew she was not, you know, a Robert's Rules kind of person, and that it would be difficult for her to be the kind of, I don't know, level-headed adjudicator of these complex issues. On the other hand, you're also right. She had this the enormous energy that you need in the early days of some kind of startup movement to get things going. And she did have enormous energy. And she was, in those first 4 years, everywhere, trying to do everything. But yeah, with the the Women's Strike for Equality situation, I mean, that's another of my favorite Betty stories, absolutely, which is, as you so aptly described it, yeah, they go out to Chicago, and they're having, first of all, they're having, Betty's supposed to deliver a parting speech, right, an exit speech, but her exit speech is like 2 or 3 hours. That's thing number one. And then thing number two is, you know, there was enormous media. Betty was always very good at kind of corralling the media. And so when she when she announced the Women's Strike for Equality, all the incoming officials of NOW were there, but then also the media was there, so they reported it. So there was no way for anyone to go back on it. Mm-hmm. And so you could say that was extremely shrewd of Betty. I mean, the Women's Strike for Equality, as you know, that's considered to be one of the most important events of second wave feminism, in that it really moved the National Organization for Women from a kind of small grassroots struggling organization into a different arena. Mm-hmm. And that was Betty's goal. Again, she was always terrified that it would just dry up and blow away. And, you know, in the first 4 years, in the years that she was president, NOW never had any money. I mean, they were basically just like struggling all the time as an organization. And also, their model, as you know, was the NAACP. And that's a kind of complex model for a women's organization to have, right? And it quickly became clear that that was going to be, having the NAACP as the model was going to be difficult in some ways, because one thing I think Betty did not do as effectively as maybe, I don't know, obviously she couldn't do it, is to find a language to talk about women's equality that that was different from the language of civil rights, right? I think in the early years of the National Organization for Women, when she gives these speeches, she borrows from the language of civil rights. And to some extent that works, but then also she's trying to carve out this space for women as this category. And I think there's a limitation to that language. And she was never able to figure out how to move it to the next level. And then of course she stepped down from NOW. And although she continued to be involved in NOW, you know, she was not the president of NOW. And also she moved more into a more moderate place, and she became more directly opposed with the leadership of NOW and their commitment to identity politics, sexual politics. You know, and Betty tried to start her own, you know, another women's organization. She co-founded the National Women's Political Caucus. She co-founded many things in the 60s and 70s, but none kind of had the impact of NOW. That was this one moment that quickly passed.
Right, right. What do you want or expect the reader to take away from this biography?
You know, I mean, my goal in writing this biography was really to show Betty's accomplishments. So I want readers to understand what Betty's accomplishments were. And then I want them to also understand that she was a human being and she was deeply flawed. And I think it's really hard when you're writing women's biographies to have that balance. I think there's one of the challenges, I do think there's a different kind of conversation that's had about female leaders. And so to some extent, I think Betty was unfairly treated, although I'm not defending her use of the lavender menace. I just want to say that. But I think that, you know, every leader has flaws. Every leader has clay feet. And that should not diminish their accomplishments or our appreciation or understanding of their accomplishments. And that's what I really felt has been lost in the conversation about Betty.
That's what I took away from the book as well. I was telling you earlier, after reading it, every conversation seems to go back to, like, by the way, Betty did this accomplishment. Brittany did this. Didn't realize she was there and was a member of this organization or that. That's exactly what I took away from the book as well.
Oh, thank you.
What was one of your favorite moments with Betty Friedan?
Oh, geez.
You were part of her life for a while.
Yeah. I mean, I loved interviewing, you know, I interviewed many people, like 80 people for the book. I loved doing that. You know, I loved making, I loved going to the places where she was. Like, I visited Peoria, but also Palisades, where she lived when she wrote The Feminine Mystique, and I saw her house. And you know, I just, in general, I love being in the archives also and reading the letters of people, you know, to Betty and reading about these events. So, I mean, I love research and researching things. And, you know, there are many moments that were great.
Speaking of archives, our last question are always on this podcast is, what archives did you visit? Of course, you came to the Reuther Library.
Of course,
I did. I don't know what collection you used here, but you had to go far and wide. So I'd love to know some of the other archives that you used.
So I spent a lot of time at the Betty's collection is at the Schlesinger at Harvard. And so I spent a good deal of time there looking at her collection and at other collections. One thing I should also say is that right now I feel is a golden era of you know, for women, for writing about women of this period, because many, many collections have been donated recently to the Schlesinger, for example, and other archives, and they're becoming public. And so it's possible to get a much fuller account of the second wave feminism than I think has previously been possible. So the Schlesinger and also Smith College, I visited those archives several times. And those are probably the two. I also went to NYU, Bobst Library, their labor collection there, Tamament, I think it's called. And then Columbia, I went to Columbia has a full run of Federated Press stuff. I mean, those are some of the major ones that stand out.
Excellent. That's all we like to hear. Thank you so much for joining us. I had a lot of fun talking with you today on our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Tales from the Reuther Library is a production of the Walter P. Reuther Library and Archives of Labor and Urban Affairs at Wayne State University, coming to you from the heart of the Cultural Center of Detroit, Michigan. The producers are Dan Galadner and Troy Eller English. The music was composed by Bart Bilmer. And of course, this podcast could not be done without the research and the support of the entire Reuther Library staff. For more information, please visit our website at www.reuther.wayne.edu. Thanks for listening. Say goodbye, Dan.
Goodbye, Dan.
Okay, on today's podcast, we talk with Rachel Steyer and her book, Betty Friedan, Magnificent Disputer.
For Dan? Yeah, you said Friedan.
See, I knew I was going to. For Dan. On today's podcast, we talk with Rachel Steyer and her book, Betty Friedan. Friedan?
Oh, no.
I said Friedan, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
Damn it. Why did I say Betty? And to say, you guys know the rest. Friedan?
Friedan. I am afraid to tell you.
No!
The very last time you said Friedan, you said Friedan.
Why do I say Friedan? Friedan. Friedan. You know, like my name.
Like your name.
Let's do that last paragraph then, okay?
Hello, my name is Din Galadner.
Shut up. Well, now I'm going to say it. All right, let's try this again. Or just scrap the whole thing, just move along and never do a podcast ever again. I hung up my microphone on this one.